Hello and welcome to the Ship Shape Podcast, a series of podcasts where we meet amazing people and talk about their experiences, personal, technical, and all related to the maritime world. Come and dive in, dive in.
Today on the Ship Shape Podcast, we speak with Captain Jorn Langeland, founder and CEO of the Eco Clipper, a sustainable way of shipping. Your two co-hosts today are Meryl Charette. I'm a live aboard on a Tashing Toshiba 36 in Boston, Massachusetts, and T.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is Talha Bhatte, and we have a great guest on today. Jorn, welcome to the show.
Where are you coming to us from?
So, right here in Den Helder, in, the Venice of the North in the Netherlands. Yeah, it's actually a place where we are currently refitting the Tucker, which is the first ship we are launching with the Eco Clipper company to start transporting goods emission-free. It's a sailing ship, so totally propelled by wind power. I'm currently on a sail loft because it's a nice, quiet place to talk. But down here, it's the blacksmith workshop, and out there is wood workshop, and the ship is laying out there. More ships are there in the middle of the port here.
And before we get into your background of how you even got into this, let's talk about the Netherlands a little bit. Netherlands is known for being such a marine-related industry. Can you talk a little bit on the legacy that you come from?
Yeah, well, actually, the Netherlands, half of the Netherlands is below sea level. We have many ports here, many channels, and many ships. I lived for a little while in Ireland, in the west of Ireland, and decided to come back to the Netherlands when I founded Eco Clipper because of the business environment in shipping and trading. Yeah, the Netherlands, of course, has been somewhat famous for that, I guess. It's a minuscule country. It's so small, you can't even think about it in the States, I guess. But but still, it's quite influential in the sense that it has like the largest European port, Rotterdam, in it. Basically, it's a country, but it's also a port by itself. And then there's the port of Amsterdam, of course, and there's this huge history, which, yeah, not all the aspects we can be very proud of, but some of them definitely. This huge history of sailing. In the beginning, of course, there was a lot of trading with the Baltic. But then later on, like in the 16th and 17th century, there was trading further afield to the Caribbean and to Asia. Yeah, that's some history where I guess the Netherlands is famous or infamous for.
And so, with history, I mean, history is one thing that maybe attracts most sailors, is I found that in common, right? But like, let's start at the beginning of your history. Where does this all start? Were you always on the ocean growing up? Did this happen later on in life? Where does it all begin?
So yeah, it was really for me, when I was a kid, I was really dreaming about this horizon. And also my family is kind of a family of seafarers and ship owners. So yeah, I would be on birthday parties and stuff. My uncles would be there. They would be ship's officers or captains or so, and I'd be hearing their stories. One of them I asked also, like, would it be possible to take me along one time? Actually, it happened that when I was still going to school, I was like 12 years old or so, he called my father and said, I'm now in Rotterdam with my ship and I'm bound for Copenhagen around through the North Sea. Would your son be interested to join for a few weeks?
No way. How old were you at this point?
I was 12.
Oh boy. And, this is like a great adventure at age 12.
Nice. Yeah, it was like a small cargo ship, about 700 tons or so. Yeah, we're loading like steel. But it was also, I was still going to school, so my parents had to ask my school teacher if I was allowed to go. So they called him, and when he heard the story, he said like, yeah, of course he should go. He'll probably learn more at sea than he will.
100%. 100%.
Send me off.
I love it. Okay, so that's where it begins for you. You're like, okay. And then, but like, did you know it was going to become a lifelong passion at that point? Like, did it take over like that? Or were you like, oh, this is cool, but I don't know, maybe
I wanted to become an architect.
Right? Maybe become an architect, right? Okay. So 12, this happens. Then?
So what happened? I just joined because of the adventure. First night at sea, terribly seasick. Waves coming over the hatches and everything, like total different world. I couldn't understand what was going on. Mm. And it's almost like a virus. You are on the ship and it's just, you are such in a different world. And then we were going to Denmark, going through the Kieler Canal, and it was midwinter, actually. It was like freezing cold out there.
Yeah, best so introduction. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a direct laugh there. But yeah, after that, I continued in the school holidays then to sail with my uncle. Went like trips to Poland and to Sweden. This was like in the summer holidays then. But at a certain point, I was kind of like, yeah, but always sailing with your family, it's not so serious. Like I wanted to sail on a ship and a shipping company, which was not owned by my family. So I asked my father to call some other shipping companies. Then I was like 15 or so. But he was calling like through all the different Dutch shipping companies, but they wouldn't get me on board because I was too young. They were like, yeah, it's not allowed. When you're 15, you can't go to sea in these times yet. But almost at the end of calling through this booklet he had, he got like a ship broker's firm. They were working with a couple of ships who are foreign flagged, and one of them was Cyprus flag. This ship was just loading a cargo in Rotterdam then, bound for the Mediterranean, for Italy.
And are these sailing vessel? Is this a sailing vessel?
This was motor cargo ship. This was in the 90s. And in those days, there were very, very few, almost no sailing vessels. I wasn't aware of any sailing vessels back then. So it were motor cargo vessels. Yeah. And this one on the Cyprus flag was about 3,000 tons, which is like 100 trucks or so, something like that. But we were with a very small crew there. And my parents brought me to the port of Rotterdam. Yeah, when I arrived there, and the captain, he was there and he really looked like a pirate. He had his working clothes with all like dirty and kind of holes in it and all. And he is like the captain of this big, big ship. And he comes down and he looks at my parents. He first looks at me and then he looks at my parents. He talks to my father and he's like, yeah, he's really small, huh? And he's really young. Are you sure he's gonna join on this voyage? Because he needs to know that I don't believe in seasickness. So if he becomes seasick, he just needs to continue working because we don't have any people on board here as a passenger. They just need to continue working. So yeah, my parents asked me and I'm like, yeah, no problem. I go anywhere.
Really? Really? But you had some experience under your belt already, right? So had you gotten over your seasickness?
No, was it all in the mind? What happened? So here we go out to sea, Rotterdam. Beautiful, beautiful weather. Summer day, huh? It just became a school holiday, and you don't really sail. We motored out, and it's summer weather. But we're going through the North Sea. It was not getting night, so I was going to bed, and then the next morning I woke up, and we are in the English Channel, motoring south. And it was beautiful weather, like blue sky all over the place, and nice sunshine, and there was like a real gentle swell, so the ship was moving gently on the swell, and I was really seasick.
I could see that coming. Oh boy, okay, so it wasn't all in the mind. Okay, then?
No, it wasn't so nice. So then, then what actually happened, I just had to continue working, but it was like this, that the working hours were like something like from 8 in the morning till 10, and then there was a 15-minute coffee break, and then at 12 o'clock, there was lunchtime for an hour, and then we would work till 3 o'clock or so for another 15-minute coffee break, and then till 5 or 5:30 or so, and then the working day was over. So what I did, I would just work during those working hours and do rust chipping and painting and whatever needed to be done, being really seasick. But then when I had a break, a coffee break or a lunch break or whatever break, I would go into my bunk and be seasick. So after a few days, here we're crossing the Bay of Biscay, beautiful weather, but I'm seasick. But in a few days, I woke up And I'm like, whoa, they didn't wake me up for work. I need to run for the deck. So I ran to the deck and I'm like passing the mess room, and there the crew is sitting all in the mess room. They're like having a drink or watching some movies. I'm like, what's going on? Is there no work to be done? Mm-hmm. They're like, well, yeah, but it's 8 o'clock at night. So because I had continued like sleeping so much and trying to be seasick, I had totally mixed up the hours.
Wow.
But I continued being seasick until...
Yikes.
At a certain point.
Did working take your mind off it though? Or are you still like seasick while working as well?
Yeah, well, this is actually a good question, because the captain, he of course was this old shellback, and he had a very good idea for me to get rid of my seasickness. So he gave me 2 buckets and he sent me with those buckets into the engine room. One bucket was to puke in, and the other bucket had some gas oil in it, some marine diesel oil and a brush, so I could clean the big engine filters with this marine diesel oil sitting next to the engine, like this huge, like 2000 kilowatt engine room. And here I am with 2 buckets, one bucket to puke in, one bucket to clean these filters.
It's like, here's something to keep your mind off it.
Yeah. Oh boy. But this was just the beginning, of course.
And you managed after all of this to continue being in the shipping industry. So what is the progression?
Well, I wanted to stop it, of course, but it kept dragging me in. So after this voyage, I was going to go to Nautical College. But when we arrived in Italy, I called my parents and said, well, no Nautical College for me. I'm maybe cancel that school. I'm going to do something else.
Wow.
And then, of course, I wanted to leave the ship in Italy, but the captain said, no, you can't leave here because you signed on to the ship's articles and it's a huge hassle to get you from board. It's not possible with customs, etc. So you'll stay on board. So that was done. And so I continued with him back to the Netherlands again. But the nice thing was, and this was kind of like a game changer, I could say, is that I kind of got used to the seasickness a little bit better. So I started when I was sitting in the wheelhouse. Wheelhouse was kind of like a living room on these small coastal cargo ships. We would be sitting in the wheelhouse and I would have paper with me, and I'm drawing like sailing ships, because these sailing ships I saw in books of my father. And my father was like really collecting like maritime books and stuff. So I was quite inspired about sailing ships. I really wanted to sail on sailing ships, but I didn't know that that existed still to work commercially. So I was making drawings of these sailing ships. And this captain came to me one day and he said like, well, it seems like you're not so comfortable on motor ships here. Did you know there is like a fleet of sailing passenger ships who operate from the Netherlands? They also look for mariners, and maybe that would be something for you, because if you're on a sailing ship with the sails kind of steadying, it might be a bit easier. So yeah, I didn't forget that. And when I returned to the Netherlands, I kind of did some different schooling. But when I was 18 and I was done with this schooling, the sea was longing, of course. But I had remembered that there were these sailing ships. And it is true that in the Netherlands, there's about 400, well, back then it maybe was even a bit more, about 400 big steel sailing barges who sail with passengers. They're like converted old sailing cargo ships converted to passenger use. Within the Netherlands, it's quite a small country. So the town I was born is Delft, and one of the ports where these sailing ships operated from is Harlingen. And it's about, it's a couple of hours drive to the north. So I hitchhiked to Harlingen and walked along the quays to talk to the different skippers and captains of these sailing vessels to ask if they had a berth vacant for some sailor. And then I found a ship, which was my first sailing ship, actually, to sign on to.
Do you remember the name? Schooner,
the Koh-i-Noor, she was called.
Koh-i-Noor. And, that's nice. Wow.
She was originally built as sailing cargo ship in Denmark, maybe the north of Germany. And she was built out of steel from old boilers of big steamships. So here I was on the Koh-i-Noor which was basically just sailing in the Netherlands, but also sometimes going on the North Sea. And I noticed on these sailing ships, this was my first time sailing, I actually didn't really get so much seasick anymore. So that was a good start working
that's
on
cool.
sailing ships.
Wait. So motor, as soon as you made that jump, so your body was literally like telling you, this is not for you, this is not for you, this is not for you. And then you get in tune with the waves on a sailing vessel and life is good. No more.
You would say so, huh? You would say so.
Really? Zero. Just from like everyday seasick to no seasick.
Well, wow. Yeah, actually, the past 20 years or so, I've never been seasick.
Wow.
And I've, I got some storms going.
You should get the Nobel Prize for sailing or something, you know, like for figuring that one out. Nice.
Okay, so let's start talking about how you came up with Eco Clipper. So what was the progression that made you realize this opportunity?
So yeah, actually, I continued sailing, saw like a documentary about a sailing cargo ship, which was still operating in the Caribbean, the schooner Aventur.
So yeah, tell us a little bit more about a schooner. What's a schooner?
So schooner is a sailing ship with at least two masts. And usually the foremast is slightly lower than the mainmast. You can have schooners up to seven-masted schooners, which was the biggest ever. So actually, one of those schooners, a two-masted schooner, was still trading in the Caribbean in the 90s under the command of Captain Paul Wallen. And somehow I got on board there as well. So firsthand, I could experience the possibility of using sail power for transport. And this was also because when I was sailing on this Koinor schooner, I really liked the sailing, but the passenger part and just kind of sailing from A to B with just people, yeah, I didn't really see the point of it so much. Yeah, I just like to carry cargo.
What sort of credentials did you need to sort of land this job in this giant on this giant sailing vessel?
This was last century, huh? Yeah, you could just still sail without any papers. Like the, especially in the Caribbean, there was like many ships just trading. And you could just come to a ship and you could say, well, okay, I'd like to become a crew member and maybe work first a little bit to show that you had the right hands. And then, you could just go. But nowadays it's totally different. Like everything is regulated and it's a lot more difficult, of course, to land a job on a sailing vessel. But there is many tall ships nowadays and you can book like a trip on there and kind of then you pay actually to get experience. And then at a certain point, when you have done that for a while, then then you might have the possibility to start sailing somewhere. There's still kind of the short track, and that would be to go like in springtime to the Netherlands and try to find a job on one of these passenger sailing vessels who are sailing in the Netherlands. And then you're not really sailing at sea because usually they stay in the inshore waters on the big lakes in the Netherlands. But it's a very nice place to learn sailing and to get experience. And then when you have done that like half a year or so, then it becomes a lot easier to find a job on a seagoing ship. Also, what works really good is joining a refit team and just go on a refit of a sailing ship and helping out. And then at a certain point, the ship needs to go to sea. And sometimes there's still some berths available. And then if you're lucky and if you're the best, then the captain might choose you to join.
That's a good tip. So what you just spoke about was like sort of where you'd ended up. You figured out, okay, sailing's for me, and you figured out I want to do cargo, and then but you still haven't like built your own first boat or any of that. That hasn't started, right?
No, I sailed on some other ships in between, and then in 2000 I was I also went to nautical college. Then there's a beautiful, really nice nautical college here in the Netherlands. It's called the Enkhuizer Zeevaartschool or the Enkhuizen Nautical College. And nowadays they also give like classes in English. So it's possible for international students to go there as well. Mm. And it gives like a course of about 20 weeks, the winter time that the sailing ships are sometimes laid up anyway. And then you get like your license for a mate on coastal sailing vessels. And you can do a second year and then you get your license for a mate on or master on ocean-going sailing vessels. So this is actually the course I did. And when I was going to that school, I actually ended up on the three-masted bark Europa crossing the Atlantic Ocean from Cadiz to Bermuda and then to Norfolk, Virginia. So this was like an ocean crossing. And after that, there was like the tall ship events along the East Coast. I kind of joined those and jumped ship in Halifax. And there was another ship there. I signed on to the Picton Castle. Maybe you've heard of her. She's quite famous because she sailed already like, I don't know, like 10 times around the world or so. She's a three-masted bark. You might be asking, what is a bark? It's like a ship with minimum three masts, with the aft mast, fore and aft rigged, and the main mast and the foremast square rigged. And if you have like a three-masted bark, and then a four-masted bark would be a ship with four masts, with the aft mast, fore and aft rigged, and the main mast, basically the other three masts square rigged.
Wow. So this is like one of those classic sort of iconic pictures almost, if you can imagine, right? Of like
square-masted sails. Yeah, it's kind of the final transition of the most efficient sailing cargo ship is a bark. Yeah, really. But so I joined this bark Picton Castle in Halifax, and then we did the Great Lakes tour, actually going all down the St. Lawrence Seaway and up to the lakes, and then ending up in Chicago, and we jumped ship there. I stayed for about half a year there and built another boat
So you're building South boats. Haven, how'd you get into that part though? Like, what called you to that? Was it just like, oh, this is what I got to do now? Like, what happened there?
Well, yeah, if you really want to know it.
Yeah.
So we were actually on the Atlantic crossing. I met, which became two friends and later companions or co-founders. But those two friends, one of them, when we arrived in Norfolk, he hitchhiked to South America, to Peru, because he had a friend there and he needed to help to build a youth hostel there on the beach. And we stayed on the ship, but we were kind of dreaming about sail cargo because we thought, okay, that would be a cool thing to build a sailing cargo ship, maybe in South America, because plenty of wood there and you can go on the beach and it would be kind of an awesome thing to do. But yeah, we needed to go there. And we were kind of brainstorming what the best way would be to go down to South America. And when we arrived on the Great Lakes, we were already on the bark Picton Castle. And we were thinking, well, maybe we can actually join her for a round the world trip. But it didn't really work out. And we thought, well, maybe we should go overland somehow to South America. And we were thinking about getting horses to go down as far as possible. But then we realized when we were entering with the Picton Castle in South Haven, Michigan, there was like a maritime museum there and there was very friendly people. And we met some of the local managers of D&W, and they were like, yeah, what cool what you guys are doing. And we're kind of telling our stories. And then we thought, well, maybe we can just build a raft and sail down the Mississippi with it. Yeah, because then we're all the way south already. And we proposed that to them. They're like, yeah, right, that might be a good idea. Our daughter just left home. We have a room available. So if you guys want to stay here to build your raft, then you're very welcome.
Yeah. So when you say raft, step away. What does raft mean?
Like some wooden structure which floats. So okay, you can paddle down a river or so. And so we couldn't leave the Picton Castle right away because, you can't just say, okay, well, bye-bye. So we had to go another port. So we went to Chicago, and there we jumped ship and we took the Greyhound back to South Haven. And we actually stood on the doorstep of these people and we're like, yeah, here we are. We're going to build this raft.
We're here to build some raft.
And they're like, yeah, welcome, come in. And then we went to the local maritime museum and we asked them, do you maybe have a workshop? We need to build a raft to sail down the Mississippi. And they had a beautiful workshop where they built like canoes and stuff, the Petnose Boat Shed. And we were invited to make use of it. And when we saw this workshop, we were like, wow, this is big, big workshop.
We can make more than a raft. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You're right on my page here. So we are measuring these doors and we are like, yeah, we are not going to build a raft. We're going to build a boat here. So the doors were like 12 feet wide and 12 feet tall and stuff. So we are like, well, we can have, this will be the beam. This will be
and then we will just erect the mast after and boom. Wow. Sure.
And we are like kind of investigating the size and I'm making drawings and we're thinking like we can build like a nice boat, but maybe it would even fit to build like a cargo boat in here with like a little cargo hold and a forecastle for the crew and an aft cabin for ourselves. Nice. So we started actually building this replica or kind of replica of a Dutch flat bottom cargo barge in South Haven, Michigan.
You still need like lots of materials. How are you funding this?
Well, actually, I'm an artist as well, so I make drawings. Uh-huh. And with these tall ship events, I have made like drawings of the ships there and sold them. So we got quite some money from that because those events, there's millions of people coming and they all want to take a souvenir. I was selling like these prints. And so we had quite a bit of money, maybe something like $10,000 or so.
Nice. And this is crazy. This is that same thing with, that you said way back that you were just like drawing sailing vessels and you're the old captain.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. That's what this turned into. Very, very cool.
And then, we basically made a drawing of a ship we were going to build. We pre-cut everything. We built like a big model to show the local people how we're going to build it. And then like a local sawmill came in. So we launched this boat the 2nd of April. And we christened her the Pyrrhus Magnus, which is like a Frisian, in the Netherlands, you have Friesland, which is in the north. It's kind of like a separate country, but it isn't a separate country. But it's kind of like with England and Scotland. And in England and Scotland, you have like Braveheart and stuff. And in Friesland, you have Grote Pier. And that's like the big pier, Pyrrhus Magnus. So we called the boat this way. And then we rigged her. And I think it was May or so that we did our maiden voyage to the Tulip Festival in Holland, Michigan.
and so this was a cargo vessel. How big was this? How big did you guys go?
So she was about, I think she was about 35 feet over the hull and about 52 feet overall. And she could take about 10 tons of cargo. So she had like a forecastle with two bunks and a stern cabin with two bunks. And then she had like cargo hold of 10 tons. And wow, she was rigged with one mast with a square rig on it as well, like a square topsail, square course, and then she had a mainsail and a couple of jibs. So quite a quite and, a little nice little vessel. Sail. In the end, those two of my friends, they crossed the ocean with it. Wow. So must be, she must have been some seaworthy little vessel, yeah.
Nice.
But no engine, so...
Ooh, so and what sort of sailing rig did you guys give her? Was it a bark?
So, like a square rig sloop, basically.
A sloop, okay, but tell us about a sloop. So we've heard bark, we've heard schooner, sloop is?
Yeah, sloop is one mast. Usually a sloop is one mast without the jib boom, I think. And the cutter would be like a one mast with two head sails or more. And like a sloop would be with one head sail. I guess that's the termination.
So you kept it simple though. Yeah, you kept it simple.
Yeah, yeah.
One mast.
Well, we had about 8 sails or so. if you're interested in it, there's I wonder if you can find it, but there is a little YouTube movie about building this boat and sailing it away. It's like 20 years old, so you see all these people like with beards and with like, it's a nice little
very
movie.
Cool. Very cool.
I can send you the link.
Sure. We'll put it in there. Yeah.
And so you have this successful building of the boat and you built this thing to carry cargo. So your mind's on that. Now, what happens next? How do we get to Eco Clipper?
A lot happens next. at a certain point, I jumped ship from this Spurious Magnus because we thought we were going to be two captains, but that didn't work out. So I decided to go. In the meantime, I met somebody in Grand Rapids and we moved in together. Since I'm an artist as well, I did some art shows there and stuff and moved on. Basically, my visa ran out and I had to go anyway. So yeah, moved on and went back into working on motor ships because I needed to earn some money to actually to come back again or so.
To support Spartan lifestyle, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I was working a bit on the motor cargo ships and then, at a certain point I went, I was back home with my parents and I went like to a movie theater with like a movie about the explorer Shackleton who went like to the South Pole like 100 years ago or so. And when we came out of this movie theater, I'm like, wow, I really, really would like to go there to Antarctica. And then about half an hour later, when I was back home, the telephone rang and it was Captain Klaas Gastra, the captain of the Bark Europa. And he's like, yeah, I remember 2 years ago, you crossed the ocean with us and you were actually making really nice drawings. And I'm looking for a ship's artist to join the Bark Europa on a voyage from San Diego to Easter Island, Rapa Nui, and then around Cape Horn to the Falkland Islands and from there to South Georgia, and then back to Terra del Fuego, and from there an expedition to Antarctica. Would you like
Look at that. Wow. That's the universe sending you a message right there. Nice.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I'm still thinking about this. But in the meantime, I had also, I had applied for the Royal Art School in The Hague, and I was actually invited to come there. So I had to choose or I go to art school or I go sail around Cape Horn.
So, for the artists in our community, like what is a gig like that first one you mentioned, you know, the onboard artist, what does that look like? Like you just have to give them a drawing a day or?
Yeah, I was actually supposed to make like drawings for a book about square rig seamanship. So basically a seamanship manual. He was going to write it. I was going to make the drawings. That was kind of the idea. Yeah, I would just join the watches, but instead of doing maintenance or such, I would be making drawings. And then when there would be some sail handling or some climbing the rigging or anything like that, they would haul me on the deck to help them. But in the meantime, I'd be making drawings. So I did this trip and came to Antarctica, and this was also with all kinds of biologists and researchers. And then it really hit me. It hit me right there that the world is so beautiful, but the way we are treating it as humans is kind of the way we are spoiling it and the environmental damage and all this. I really thought I want to do something about that. And then it kind of all linked together, like, okay, one of the few things I know is sailing and working on ships. So why not really, really make this change happen of transition from motor to sail and just go and do everything what is possible to get rid of these motor ships and distribute all the cargo in the world with sailing ships.
Mm. And it seemed like a giant plan right then. Okay, and so how'd you go about it? What'd you do?
Then I kind of ended up on motor ships again.
Oh, man. Okay.
Making a living.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, I was so fed up with it. And I got in contact again with my old shipmates who had by then crossed this little Spurious Magnus across the ocean. We said, okay, we're actually going to take this on. We're going to bring back commercial sailing ships on the high seas. It was 2007 then. In the meantime, I had also built like a little 30-foot sailboat for myself because I was kind of done with industrial civilization and just wanted to go away from it and just set sail and just go fishing or whatever. But yeah, then I came together with my two old shipmates and we decided, okay, we're going to do this. And then we started the company Fair Transport. That was 2007. And the first thing we're going to do was build a new sail cargo ship, a big one. So maybe like 50 tons of cargo or 100 tons of cargo.
Small, and then small is like giant for most people, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like Piers Magnus was small. Like a ship of 100 tons is really it's still small. Quite small. Like like the one we are now working on, the Tucker. She can carry about 70 tons of cargo. The ship by itself weighs about 120 tons. She has a length of 120 feet. And she's in the shipping world really small.
And how big a crew does this one need?
She will sail with 5 professional crew and 12 paying guests. Yeah.
Ooh, what? Wow. So back to the story. Yeah.
Yeah. So then we, we built this, we actually refitted this vessel, Tres Hombres, and we refitted her to become a brigantine, which is a two-masted ship with one fore and aft rigged mast, the main mast, and the foremast square rigged. And actually, the first thing we did when we purchased this hull, which is a story by itself, but the first thing we did was take the engine out to really make a statement were going to sail the ship.
Wow. Yeah. So, and, but most people, they need an engine at least to like dock and undock. What happens in those situations?
Yeah, so, well, when the situation is right, you can actually sail in and sail out.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's not, so it's all about timing.
It's it's circumstances, it's weather, it's timing, and it's location. Like, not all locations are, make it possible. Some do, but the more you come to more what they call first world countries, the harder it becomes.
Really interesting, interesting. Okay. So you pull the engine out.
Yeah, we pulled the engine out and we started refitting her. We had planned that it would take about a year, and it took in the end 2.5 years. And then we, on the maiden voyage, we sailed to the climate conference in Copenhagen, and it was a huge success. She sailed like a witch, really, really.
Sailed like a witch. I haven't heard that before. That's a good one. Okay.
Yeah.
Then.
Then we were there. We had this beautiful brigantine sailing cargo ship, which could take about 40 tons of cargo, but we did not have any cargo. The logistics systems on this world weren't ready for sailing cargo ships. So then maybe you remember the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. And then we decided, if we don't have commercial cargo, we're just going to do something different. We reached out to some NGOs to ask what was needed there.
Nice.
And then we loaded the ship full with tents and with hospital materials, medicines, whatever you could think of. And the winter of 2010, we set sail for Haiti. That was like a story by itself, of course. After arriving, we did another voyage from Port-au-Prince to Jacmel with a cargo for the World Food Program. Because in Jacmel, the roads all had been damaged, so it could only be distributed by small cargo ships. So did some sailing there. And then from there to the Dominican Republic. And we still didn't have much more cargo, so we decided to buy our own cargo. We also had not much money, so I had stayed behind and I called all our investors and arranged some money to buy a cargo of rum. And we sailed that back across the ocean. And that became the Tres Hombres rum, the famous Tres Hombres rum brand, and started selling that. And that has become kind of a tradition. The Tres Hombres is still every year sailing a cargo of rum from the Caribbean to Europe, but also other cargoes like coffee, like cacao, like things like this. The ship has been sailing for about 15 years now, I think.
So at one point here, you mentioned that you had investors, and I guess that kind of gets into this next point. It's like, you know, it seems that the shipping industry is very much kind of focusing on technology, and it's like, what is the new technology that can make something sustainable? Where when we look at you, it's like you've gone back in time. It's like, okay, this is sustainable. Can you talk on that side of things?
Yeah, it's just using common sense, huh? You just look a little bit further into history. and you just see thousands of commercial sailing ships who operated and actually arranged like a perfectly zero emission logistic system. Why wouldn't you use that again? And actually those ships, they were like built throughout the knowledge of hundreds of thousands of years.
Maybe that's what we've lost, right? Is it,
we haven't lost it. We're only not using it. It's still there. The wind is still blowing there. It will continue blowing. This is one of the first questions people always ask me, like, yeah, but sailing, it's slower, huh? It's slower.
How much slower though? Now they're touting stuff like carbon fiber this and sails that and engine.
Okay, but that's very nice to make things lighter. But that doesn't work for cargo ships. Because with cargo ships, the whole game is, of course, to carry weight, not to be as light as possible. But if you really look how long it takes to form fossil fuels, then all of a sudden sailing becomes really fast. And actually, even if you look at the passage times, then nowadays when you transport like a container from Asia to Europe, it is about 30 or 40 days. If you're lucky, because there might be big traffic jams in the congested ports, etc.
Anyway, you might be in that spot for another 30 days, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like the fastest clipper ships in the 19th century, they could sail that same route in 70 days or even a longer route because they wouldn't take the Suez Channel. If you really want to go with the Paris Climate Accords, if you really are serious about climate change or the plastic soup or any of these crises, then you only have one choice for your logistics. If you want to continue using foreign goods and traveling to foreign lands, then sailing ships it is.
And so what would you say, like a large fleet of smaller vessels or investing in bigger sailing vessels? What's the biggest a sailing vessel can go?
Nowadays, the biggest sailing vessels, they might be like a couple of thousand tons. The biggest sailing vessel built was maybe the Prosen or so, the biggest square rig one at least, and could carry about 8,000 tons of cargo. I'd say that was built in 1904 or 1902. But nowadays, of course, they could be built bigger. I guess the average container vessel is like 50,000 tons. So that's quite a bit bigger. But really what I propose, and this is something which is a bit weird maybe to hear from a ship owner, is to ship a lot less cargo. about 30% of all the commodities shipped over the world, of all the tons shipped, it's fossil fuels. 30% of what we sent over the world.
Yeah, I was going to say toilet paper.
It's fossil fuels. That's being brought by tankers and by big bulk carriers.
I believe.
Then of the rest, of course, 90% of the rest, what is being shipped, it's only being shipped because it's for manufacturers. It's easier to produce it in some Asian countries because there's no environmental laws. There's no labor laws. There's nothing like that. Or a lot less laws than we have in the USA or in Europe. So that's of course the reason a lot of our industry went abroad, because that shipping, especially with container ships, is so efficient, is so cheap. Nowadays, garbage is being shipped all around the world to be sent to Africa or so.
And it's not because Africa
shows already how ridiculous
way to deal with garbage is, just because that's the new dumping site, right? So what are you recommending though? It's like everybody, like I was reading this thing about like New Zealand honey, and they charge like 100 times more than any other honey or whatever. I don't remember the name, but is it something like that? Like everybody just picks a super niche and just sticks with it? Is that what you're saying? And everything else that you can grow, you just grow?
Yeah, of course. We need to be localized way more.
And much more localization. And what about the trash then? So you're saying we can't ship the trash? What are you supposed to do with all the trash? Yeah, where do we put it? Again, just consume less, I guess.
Maybe we could eat the trash. What about that?
Recycle more. Right? Well, compost it, right? That's something they're coming up with.
So obviously it seems that the shipping side and using the fossil fuels is quite entrenched into kind of the modern day logistics. So in terms of, sailing cargo ships, where is the clipper industry now? What would have to happen in order to scale that industry? And, I guess going off that, how you see this sailing cargo happening over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so first, after we launched Tres Hombres, that was kind of like a pioneer. And then many new projects followed. So maybe now there's about 15 sailing cargo ships sailing around, and even more wind assist ships. So they have they still have engines, but they also use wind to have less fuel use and less emissions. And also about 10 years ago, or maybe a little bit less, the International Windship Association was formed. And this is like a market organization for the industry. It has its main office in London. And now I think there's about 100 members. And that's not only small companies like our company, like EcoClipper, but also big companies, big shipping companies who are looking into using wind power. Yeah, I think actually if we are serious about environment, if we are serious about climate change, then this is the only way forward. So that will, if we really act upon all that, then we are in for some sailing ships. But it can also happen that it kind of business as usual, where we kind of say, okay, we really find green important, but in the meantime, we just fly all over the place. That's the most likely thing what will happen. And we see it happening all the time, of course, the movie Inconvenient Truth came out.
Yeah. But apparently Greta Thunberg goes around in sailing vessels to the client conferences. Right?
So that's a great example.
It's sort of, it's just showing to the world that where are we rushing to? Where are we going? Just enjoy the passage there or whatever.
You definitely see a change, of course, but it's still niche, huh? But I must admit, about 15 years ago, when I talked to somebody about sailing cargo ships, people were like, 90% of the people are like, you're absolutely nuts. You're absolutely crazy. This cannot happen. And now I'm actually on your podcast. So, that's a huge change, huh?
It is. It is. Podcasts didn't exist.
I don't know what you think, of course.
I agree. And so tell me this. So lots of people, say somebody wanted to join a board, this really sort of gets them all invigorated. And they're like, oh, I want to change the world too. I want to sail aboard a sailing vessel. I think what might freak out some of them is that, but it's so dangerous or something, right? Compared to but is that true? Compared to a motor vessel? Or would it be the same sailing experience anyway?
I think it's safer.
Safer? Oh, I love to hear this side. Tell me more.
Well, you can look at the scientific papers, but at a motor vessel, you have an engine, which is a huge cause of fires on board vessels.
90% of fires, start in engine rooms.
Yeah, right? It's true. Huh? But I think about 60% of the fires on a vessel, they start in the engine room.
60, okay.
But anyhow, when you have a good, well-found sailing vessel, you can just ride the winds, work with the nature instead of against it. When you lose power with a motor vessel, you're really lost. But with a sailing vessel, even if a sail tears, you often have more sails. Huh? It was not for nothing that in the 19th century, when the steamships came up, it took about 70 years or so that even steamships were obliged to still have sails because it wasn't deemed safe to just go to sea without sails.
That's interesting.
And why do you think that people have made such a shift from, obviously it started off as sails and then, it moved to steam and then it moved to diesel. And, talking to people in the shipping side of the industry, how they describe it is it's like right before the advent of steam, trying to figure out how to exactly do anything to make anything sustainable and new forms of transportation.
Sorry, what is exactly the question?
You see, that's the problem. Basically, what the trends of sustainability in shipping, how does that impact the wider economy? How does sailing cargo ships impact local economies?
Well, it can have a huge positive impact, actually. But it all depends how you work it out, of course. With sailing ships, we are able to actually work on a new tradition in shipping, which can be done actually with smaller vessels and also asking the true ecological price for freight, for transport, will kind of sift through what cargo should be really transported and what cargoes are actually ridiculous to transport. They are not worth to be transported. You just will have less transport, but only valuable cargoes who are worth to be transported. And then what could actually happen if we organize it politically well is that small ports become actually commercial ports again. And instead of having like, well, what happened after the Second World War is that our governments, they decided to invest heavily in road transport against waterborne transport. And if we could change that around, actually we could take some traffic jams off the roads and we could actually have some way more efficient, less energy use by moving transport to ships. And also having like small ports become economical centers again, where there is thriving business. Like you see a lot of small ports here in Europe. I don't know how it's in the USA, where the old warehouses are turned into apartment buildings. And that, of course, all needs to be reversed again to make actually the ports working ports again. And also the cities have people work and live at the same place and not having to commute for like an hour or so, because it just doesn't make sense in a time where we talk about climate change. But even more, maybe, because climate change, it's also kind of in a way, a psychological thing. Like people can just kind of say like, wow, look how it storms. Look how cold it is. It's not really happening. And that's kind of the general idea, I guess. I'd be happy if it changes, but I'm also a bit surprised. But what will happen is that the price of energy will go up and it will keep going up. That's something you cannot just say, okay, well, look, it is snowing. Nothing is happening. If you see how much it is, then you want to do something different. And maybe you actually want to stop using fossil fuels and use sailing vessels.
Tell me, as an investor, how much, say I wanted to get into, you know, sailing shipping vessels, what are the best places to start? Is it like country specific, or some countries better at it than others?
Yeah.
How much capital would somebody need? What sort of experience does somebody need to get into this?
So for investors who are looking for investing in sailing cargo vessels, well, you can always, of course, send EcoClipper a line. And,
exactly. Right?
Because first we are line. Still looking for investors. Although there is something here I need to tell, and I haven't found out a way yet, but in the Netherlands, there's some sort of law where it's harder for US or Canadian investors to invest in EcoClipper. So sorry, I'm still looking for a solution there. But there is, of course, other projects. Like, for example, there is this great project in Costa Rica, Sail Cargo, and they are actually building this 350 tons schooner on the beach in Costa Rica. So there's projects like this you could invest in. There's more projects around the world. Just go online and look for Sail Cargo, or look for clean transport, or, well, EcoClipper, of course. And then, of course, I would invite people to start their own sailing cargo companies. Ooh. But
right, that'd be the coolest.
For this, there's also a disclaimer, because it is quite some work. It's quite intricate. There's a lot of different things you have to think about. So if you want to start a sail cargo company, it's probably better to start as a mariner first on different sailing ships to kind of learn the trade. Maybe sail on a couple of sail cargo ships. Nowadays, you can just book a trip on our ship, but also on other ships like Tres Hombres, like the Aventure, like Galant. Like, there's many ships sailing around now where you can just book a berth and just try it out. Even better, of course, is just go work professionally on as many ships as you can. Just get a career in shipping, learn about shipbroking, learn about maritime economics, and then go into it. And I think then you're really paving your way to a great career, because there's no way around it. Sooner or later, the logistics will change to wind power, because if we want to continue long distance transport and travel, that's the only feasible solution.
we had a discussion with this one guy, Drew Oriento, and he was basically, he had done a program and they had the design of a cargo ship. And they were like, okay, can you put sails on this thing? Like, you know, jerry-rig this thing. And clearly that was like a no. And so it's like a situation in which a lot of boats would have to be built. Do you foresee these major shipping companies being like, okay, you know what, we're going to go with the, we're going to start making some moves, start building out some sailing ships, or are they just going to invest their money into like alternative fuels and whatnot?
Yeah, well, there is actually some shipping companies that do invest in sail, but it's only a few. And I'm afraid most shipping companies and big shipping companies are just missing the turn here. And they start thinking about biofuels or so, which is, of course, a huge drain on agricultural land.
Yeah, but it's coming from the same place that caused the problem, right?
Yeah, so it can't work. And then there's, of course, the idea of sailing electrical. But that's a huge problem with, how to store it. So it's also not feasible. Then there's the idea of using hydrogen. But hydrogen, you need to somehow make it. It's basically an energy battery. So you have to still produce it. And to produce that, it costs a lot of energy. But yeah, of course, you can use green energy. So then what you're doing, you're actually putting down windmill farms. You're making electricity of that wind. Then you make hydrogen of that electricity. Mm. Then you somehow get the hydrogen on the ship. And then you start sailing with it. Well, if you look at efficiency, that's about the worst efficiency you can find. Why not put mass on the ship right away? But somehow the coin isn't really falling yet, but it can come any moment. Of course it should. We're not all idiots.
Well, you're ahead of the curve that way. So, you know, good luck to you. I mean, it sounds like quite an adventure you've been on, you know, these last 20, 30 years more. It's really cool to hear all those stories, man. Anything you'd like to leave our listeners with? Any, you know, top tips, you know, from all your experience?
Well, I would say, really find ways to start making use of sailing vessels. So for charterers, look for sailing vessels to put your goods on. If you want to travel, look for sailing vessels to travel with instead of using an airplane. If you're interested in investing, look for sailing cargo ship companies to invest in. I think that is definitely the way forward, of course, on the industry of long distance logistics.
So where can people find you and read more about what you're doing and check out everything that you're working on?
Yeah, so it's EcoClipper. You can find it online, of course. EcoClipper.org is our website. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Insta, LinkedIn. Even on the website, you can find my telephone number and give me a call. And I'm happy to discuss any ways to make the transition to sail faster.
Awesome, Jorn. It was great talking to you and hearing all these stories.
Thanks. Well,
thank you very much. Thank you for hosting me here. And fair winds. Ahoy.
Woo. Peace.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode and be sure to like, share and subscribe to Shipshape.pro.